War. It's an exciting elixir. Is there journalism that doesn't love a war? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive. Stay tuned.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
If war didn't make for such good headlines, might peace be possible? In a world with ever-increasing competition between the media to snag your attention, the prospect of negotiation or other alternatives to war is far from exciting. Who's going to look at that? And since the news media only survives by making advertisers happy, what does that say about the chances for peace? Our guest today, Nan Levinson, asks on an essay on Tom Dispatch, is there journalism that doesn't love a war? Nan Levinson is the author of a notable anti-war book, War is Not a Game, The New Anti-War Soldiers and the Movement They Built. Her insight into this issue comes out of her teaching journalism and fiction writing at Tufts University. On today's Keeping Democracy Alive, we'll ask, does the media require at least one war to cheerlead for or fret about at any given time? We'll look at the role of the media in the monumental matters of life and death for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. With the rise of social media and tremendous numbers of options for how Americans get their news, is there a change or is there the same old, if it bleeds, it leads? What, if anything, can be done about it in a free market of news reporting? After reading her essay, I was reminded of young kids at school. What gets attention, good behavior or bad? When a kid is hit, he or she often hits back, and on it goes. The dynamic among school kids is one thing, but as we know all too well, far too many innocent lives are needlessly sacrificed in preventable, avoidable mass violence known as war. Well, today we'll look into the question of the media's level of responsibility. Nan Levinson, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
I'm glad to be here.
Nan Levinson is a writer, journalist, and until recently a lecturer at Tufts University. Her books include War is Not a Game, about ever-surprising anti-war soldiers and the movement they built in the aftermath of 9/11, and Outspoken, Free Speech Stories, featuring a mixed bag of Americans embroiled in free expression battles, many repeating themselves today. She was U.S. correspondent for Index on Censorship, and before that, she worked in arts administration, including a stint at the National Endowment for the Arts. Well, again, thanks. There's no disagreement that whenever is like a life is taken through violence, it's a tragedy. We can respond any number of ways, not the least of which is to learn from the circumstances how and why it happened. One such incident was the January 2024 deaths of three American soldiers killed by a drone attack in Jordan. Of course, the shocking incident made headlines. And as you point out, Nan, the United States responded to the killing of the three by bombing 85 targets in Jordan, alleged to be connected to Iran, which we were assured was responsible for the attack. No doubt way more than three Jordanians or perhaps Iranians were killed in our overwhelming response. If that will have its desired effect, of course, remains to be seen. So, if you could, Nan, please tell us about the media's actions following the drone attack on that initial killing of the three, and what concerns you have about that.
Before I do that, can I do a little throat clearing here, which is that I want to say, first of all, I'm talking about the American news media, which does things a certain way. Not every country does it the same way. The second thing is, I really am not meaning to be critical of individual journalists. I think journalists do really important work. I think war correspondents often endanger themselves to bring us essential information. And I appreciate and I admire that.
Oh, yes.
What I'm talking about pretty much is the context within which they work. So having said that, the response was, oh my God, three Americans killed. And it's significant because it was the first group of first Americans, as far as I know, who were killed in relation to the conflict in Gaza, Israel and Gaza. So it's news and it's significant. the White House responded by kind of not responding, but coyly saying, we're going to do something. I'm just not going to tell you what it is. And journalists don't like not being told what it is, for good reason. I don't either. It pisses me off that somebody won't tell me something. So there was a lot of speculation and a lot of saying, are we going to bomb? And can you, and then once the White House seemed to indicate that they were going to do some sort of military response, it was trying to pin down what that would be. And I actually point to a piece in Columbia Journalism Review, which actually is a very good piece. It's called, the headline was, let me find it if I can get the right headline.
Is the press dragging America to war again?
Thank you. Yes, that's it. And the answer was really more nuanced than just that. But my response to the headline was, again, shouldn't that be still?
Right.
I mean, it's this knee-jerk response that how are we going to respond to this? Well, we're going to respond militarily. And some of the Washington Post had an editorial in which it said devastating retaliation is imperative for several reasons. And that was kind of the tone of it. And by asking questions about what kind of ammunition or what kind of bombs we would drop, it wasn't necessarily saying we must, but the implication is that we're going to.
Right.
Simply by putting directing the conversation in that way, which is where the press is significant, has some significant impact.
Interesting. It seems like, if I hear you right, it's that the context of what happened, the reaction to the three being killed, is that there was a feeling that war is inevitable. Like, you don't question it. It's like, not what are we going to do? What are we going to do? It's going to be a military response. So that just goes without saying. And that the journalists come to expect that, as everybody else, I guess, does. I'm sure there may have been other options after the three were killed other than, you know, hitting back harder, which we know what that does. It just leads to more and more and more hits. I wonder, you know, I've long thought, and I respect reporters tremendously, the work that they do, the people that put themselves in the bang, you know, in the actual war situation. It's amazing to me, and I have tremendous respect for them. And they, you know, they're there to discover the truth and also to, at least in theory, press for full disclosure of important facts. Do journalists these days of the 24/7 instant, constant news cycle find it expedient to just skip that step of pressing for disclosure of important facts?
No, I would say no, but there are hot takes. And the pressure is to have an opinion or have information immediately. I used to tell my students, you don't have to have an opinion on everything. But that's a rare idea. I mean, people would kind of stare back and be like, oh, really? And journalists, there is pressure. Yes, the pressure is you get the graph up right away, and then you work on it, and you add to it. And so over time, in fact, they do explore. And journalists are good at research. They're good at finding out stuff. I mean, that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But it can take time. It's fair enough. I mean, that we're lied to. We're not necessarily told stuff.
Right.
But there is that's the 24/7 news cycle and the kind of pressure for eyes, for people constantly checking, which I do, I have to say, my email or my updates or whatever,
sure, yeah,
or the crawl across my screen, does pressure journalists to get things up right away.
Right.
And I think maybe it's a human instinct to go to the most most extreme, or the most eye-catching, and the most horrible, or whatever it may be. An example fairly recently was whether or not babies were beheaded by Hamas on November 7th, which was a horrific story. And the press for a while was a little careful about it, but it did go up. I mean, it kind of followed where it went for a while and how it got put up. And it was always put up with a lot of disclaimers. And as far as I know, it was never really confirmed to the level that I think it should be. But there was the pressure to respond to that story, to say something, to do something, to even say we're not going to put it up there, which in a way confirms it.
Hmm. And I'm reminded, as you described that, of the and if regular listeners know I'm a World War One fanatic, that the story was that the Germans invading Belgium nailed Belgian babies to church doors.
Ooh.
It wasn't, there was no truth, but it grabs attention. And it Donald Trump knows this very well, that it doesn't have to have necessarily truth to it, just a quick, you know, summation of what happened so that it paints a picture really quickly in people's minds. And that's got to be, you know, and obviously the news media has been around for, you know, a couple hundred years. And there's always, as far as I know, been pressure to beat the other guys, to get the story up first. And that continues now. And that's in the way. And I wonder if, you know, the manner in which the killing of the three soldiers was reported and its style, you know, we've all been concerned about the risk of a larger regional war since the October 7th Hamas attack on Israeli citizens. Does the reporting in its style have the effect of serving to perhaps unintentionally advocate for a wider war?
I don't know, is the answer. I'm not a diplomatic correspondent. There are people who know much, much more about backstory and back channels, and certainly also about military issues, how armies work, or whatever. I think there certainly has been continued attention to it. So it's always in our minds, in the back of our minds, let's say. It's a fear.
Fear.
And I think journalism does work by way of fear, of anxiety. I don't think that's necessarily their intention, but that's often what happens. And because, again, that does draw attention. And it's not just advertisers. Most journalists do have to be aware of the business of journalism, because
right.
if someone isn't paying for it, it doesn't exist.
Right.
But I think most journalists do their work, trying to do their work, and not saying, is this going to make my advertiser happy? They think, is it going to make my editor happy? Which may be another story. But somehow that to keep us perpetually anxious. And, you know, the reality is evil is more interesting than good. You look at medieval paintings, and hell is much more interesting than heaven.
Yeah. It
just
is. And it captures the eyes, for sure. Oh, my goodness, if you think about all the frescoes in churches all throughout Europe, yeah, there's a lot of images of that. And it tells the story. Every picture tells a story. And just keep it quick and go for the, you know, grab the eyes and catching the eyes. It's so hard. You know, the competition, it's just so, there's so much coming at us as American citizens these days, you know, to be able to catch the attention. It's got to be pretty juicy stuff. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. And we're talking about journalism. The question we're asking Nan Levinson, our guest, is there a journalism that doesn't love a war? One thing about the American public is pretty clear. We get bored easily. Russia's war on Ukraine has dragged on since February 2022. One can no longer count on coverage of the destruction being in the lead sections of the nightly news report on TV. I did wonder about the timing of drummed-up allegations. I'm not sure where the allegations came from. Maybe the State Department, who knows, CIA, whatever, of Putin wanting to put a nuclear weapon into Earth orbit. Such a scenario was exceedingly effective at drumming up fear in the 1950s when the Soviet Union launched its Sputnik. It really boosted fear, for sure, and with it, military spending and the political usefulness of the Cold War. Should part of the job of journalists have been to check out the veracity of the allegations, or would that have been beyond their expected scope? And my sense is that the actual truth was, and I may be wrong here, so because we couldn't get to it, that there was going to be nuclear technology perhaps used in Earth orbit, but not necessarily actual weapons. But do you think the could the journalists have checked it out, or was that beyond their possible scope?
Oh, I think they did check it out, in all fairness. But again, it's, you know, most people read headlines or the lead sentence or a crawl across the bottom of their phone or whatever. You have to read deep into stories. Journalists did do this. And in fact, you know, it wasn't like nobody knew about it. It was that Michael Turner, the representative from Ohio, revealed it. And now, I think that probably there was a political reason for him doing it. Although, yeah. You know, I don't know. I don't know why he did it. I have no idea. I don't know him. I can't. I could speculate, and there was some speculation. But it was. I think this. If you read the stories, I think they did point out what it was about. I think they did point out that, in fact, this has been around for a while, and that a lot of people did know about it. It just hadn't been reported, partly because it wasn't necessarily worth reporting. But when the congressman made the statement, he pushed it to the front, and there needed to be a response. Needed to be a response from the White House. There needed to be a response from the various intelligence committees, all of that. I think journalists do check things out, but again, it can take time. And yeah, you know, it's almost impossible to get a scoop these days. Everyone has information pretty quickly. It might last 2 minutes if you're lucky. There is stuff that no one else wanted to publish that sometimes can get you. ProPublica, for instance, is really good at deep dives and does this sort of stuff, information that other people might have but aren't doing anything with. So I think it's more that, not that they don't research, it's when and how, and it's also what gets published. And that is the gatekeeping function that we probably should talk about.
Well, yeah, please do, right? Sure. This is a good spot to talk about the gatekeeping function. Not everybody listening is aware of what that means.
What I mean by it is there are people in any newsroom, I'll use it as shorthand kind of news platform situation, who decide what is going to be covered, what is going to go up, what's going to be the first story, what's going to be kind of buried, sometimes what day it's going to be published on, which makes a difference because people read differently on the weekend. They read, I'm not sure if this is still true, but I think social media stuff and reading goes up around lunchtime during the week. So all of that does matter. But it's also simply the question of what is news and who decides what is news. And we have certain conventions that have been developed over time, and journalists usually abide by them. Editors do. So, you know, as a journalist, you can have a story and you can pitch it, and you pitch it five times and it gets shot down five times. You stop pitching it. You go someplace else. So there is that gatekeeping function. It's also kind of the framing of stories, which I guess is another journalism term. How we look at the news, how it's presented to us. You can take the same set of facts and you can present them a lot of different ways. There's also, I can go on forever on this. I'm sorry.
Stop me at any time.
There is what's called balance or both-sidism, which is, you know, if you have one from column A, you have to have one from column B. And that's a convention that actually is under attack by a lot of journalists now. My take on it is somewhat different. My problem with it is both sides usually have more than two stories. And by kind of winnowing everything down to just two sides, you miss out on a lot. You miss out on a lot of other ways of thinking about it. It narrows our thinking.
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, dividing it into just two stories, it's simpler. And, you know, there is this tendency to make things simple and straightforward. And as you mentioned, you know, the both sides-ism. I've been to, and my history is out there for, you know, no secret. I was involved in many anti-war, anti-nuclear protests. And their journalists, particularly TV journalists, it seemed clear to me, felt compelled to do the both sides. And if there were 100 people on one side and 2 or 3 people on the other, they'd make it look like it was even. So that necessity, the you know, having to look fair or whatever, that's I'm glad to hear that that is being criticized by reporters these days, because it can twist the news, what's really going on. And as you write, it's not the journalists and are particularly callous or a bloodthirsty lot. And I know for sure. Some of my best friends are journalists, and I, you know, used to be as well. It's, you know, that journalists are not a particularly callous or bloodthirsty lot. It's that war makes good copy. As perhaps some listeners remember from Zap Comics, Mr. Natural, who said, "'Twas ever thus. War makes good copy." Was Chris Hedges right when he said that war is an exciting elixir? What does that mean, do you think, in this context?
I can answer that by reflecting on, in my book, I talk to a lot of veterans and active duty soldiers. Uh-huh. And granted, most of them had turned against the wars they were fighting. So it is a select lot, but not all of them. But even the ones who were against the war, it was clear to me that being in war, not the boring part where you're sitting around all the time, but when you're actually in a battle or in a dangerous situation, was like nothing would ever be again in their lives. It was exciting, horrifying, scary, but it felt incredibly real. It was something they would never be able to not make a part of them. And I think that's a sense of war. And I suspect it's true for people who are not combatants, who are caught up in war too. It reduces everything to the moment, mm-hmm. Of survival often. And so it is a part of life, and it is interesting, and it is compelling, and it's all of that. And I think for war reporters, from what I understand, it gets into you. It becomes almost addictive. Mm. It's hard to break. And actually, Hedges is an interesting person to follow, because he stopped doing it and started being quite actively political in his writing. And right. So his book is an interesting meditation on it. For our readers, is it armchair excitement? Probably. I don't know if people imagine what they would do in this situation or not. And what I go on to say in the piece, though, is it's very compelling for politicians also. It, you know, makes good speeches. We rise to the occasion. And I have just 3 instances in which history is watching. History is always watching. You know, we'll look over your shoulder. It's there. Mm-hmm. It comes up in every goddamn speech. And that's a way of saying what we do at this moment is absolutely essential. We better not screw it up.
Mm. Well, yeah. I've heard it said, and it's so true, that politics is so much theater. You know, there's climaxes and just catching the attention, even for a brief time. And to have something, I mean, being, you know, in the trenches or, you know, up where the bombs are going off, I can see how it could be addictive. And you can't do that all the time. It's like, you know, some bad drug that you can't, I mean, it would be crazy to do it all the time. But at the moment, wow, it's exciting as all heck, you know, and I can see why that happens. And I guess the theater aspect of politics also plays true for journalism as well. And along those similar lines, how does war make us feel noble? How is it useful for politicians? What about that feeling noble in a war?
I'm not sure that people feel noble in the war, but the politicians feel noble in conducting a war.
Good clarification, yes. Good.
I guess, you know, I immediately think of Zelensky, who was elected, and people said, God, he's an actor who played a president. He's kind of a comedian.
Yes.
And his country was invaded, and they went to war. And boy, did he rise to the occasion. I mean, he's really good. And he knows how to enlist sympathy and enlist allies and impress upon everyone how absolutely essential the war in Ukraine is to the world. I mean, he's convinced everyone of that. And politicians elsewhere, not just in the United States, but throughout Europe, almost throughout Europe, also use the same rhetoric that this is a fight for democracy. This is an essential. This is absolutely important. I'm not saying it isn't necessarily, and I'm not unsympathetic to Ukraine.
Oh, for sure.
But it's the rhetoric. And, you know, we use the language of war and of the military and battles. It so pervades our culture. Think about all our political campaigns in battleground states.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest one is a force multiplier, which I just read twice today in the morning paper, having nothing to do with the military. It's a military term that means, you know, you could have something that makes an action more effective through something else you do.
Mm-hmm.
Not a very good definition, but that's pretty much what it is. It was applied to lawyers and AI in one piece, and another, I think it was, again, to a campaign. And suddenly we're going to hear about force multipliers. But the language is there. It pervades our culture. And language is really important in how we think about things.
No question about it. Language, that's how we think. And I was in my teens teens and early 20s during the America's war in Vietnam. And we have not, in my opinion, learned from that war that you don't take over another country and install a government that the people don't want. But that seems to have not been learned. But one thing that was learned was that by the Pentagon was that you got to rein in the reporters, because they were really concerned that the journalists on the ground showed a true picture of Vietnam and showed that we couldn't win. And so during the invasion of Iraq in 2003, we had what were called at the time embedded reporters. They traveled as part of the American mission, and it appeared that their role was more boosting than skeptical reporting. So the Pentagon had learned. In the Israeli war on Gaza, there have been reporters who also seemed to be boosters, I've noticed. Yet I'm often amazed these days at some of the TV reporters who do take great personal risks to get story. Given the needs of business and the news media, it is a business, you know, they got to pay people. They don't do it out of the goodness of their hearts. Given the needs, the needs of business, talk about the context of what journalists are faced with in war situations. And what about that embedded reporter situation? I think we've done away with that, or at least here in America.
My take on the embedded reporters in Iraq, I heard from several of the that they were kind of whenever they were with their unit cleaned up their act a lot, that it was not necessarily an accurate picture of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what's happening in Gaza, my understanding is that it's really hard to get anywhere near Gaza. So what we're getting is the reporting comes from largely Palestinian reporters, people who live there and who are already there, who can get the information out. And it's not necessarily easy to get the information out. There are blackouts on you know, being able to get any information in or out at certain points. As I understand it, the Israeli government and military is being very careful about when and who they will let in.
I'll bet.
And usually they are accompanied and allowed only in certain places. So, this is a real problem that, you know, in general, it's not like we don't have enough information. We usually have too much information.
No.
But the question is where it comes from. So local news, for instance, there's a dearth of it in a lot of places. There are news deserts in the States. That's a problem. The fighting in Ethiopia when no journalists could get in was total blackout. We didn't know what was going on. We knew something awful was going on, but couldn't find out anything. In Israel and Gaza, I think it's quite controlled. Although it's interesting to me because I think American journalists are really trying very hard on this one. And in this case, where I think the U.S. press started out being sympathetic to the Israeli government, I think that shifted. At least my read of it is from what I read. They're much more critical of it.
I've been impressed with that as well, and I'm very much impressed at the chutzpah, if you will, of people, reporters, looking more deeply into the issue. And it must drive the Israeli government crazy that they do look into it, that they, I'm sure the Israeli government would not want the rest of the world to know how many kids have been killed and the suffering and the, you know, because it doesn't fit their, you know, we're the good guys picture. And it's interesting, you know, we all know about, you know, since 9/11, the extreme jihadists who speak of a holy war to cleanse the infidels from their midst. It's not entirely different here in the West. The side of the good selflessly taking on the bad guys. In this context, how does the news media push eye-catching war stimuli instead of putting forth any reports about discussion of negotiation or other non-war options? Is it that the news media thinks the public doesn't want to hear about such things, as it would look like betrayal? What are your thoughts?
I think to a certain extent, yes. And I think that comes out of the way we talk about it and out of the way we frame it as, you know, worthy and unworthy, or good and bad, or good for the Dems or bad for the Republicans, or it often comes down to, you know, political horse races in the U.S. And in all fairness, every country I know about, journalism does focus on their own country, as we do.
Of course.
We're pretty geocentric in our views of everything. I think it's less that we get stories here and there about peace groups in Israel and Palestine. I've seen a few of the New York Times had a couple. It's not like there's none of that. And in fact, now there is, it seems to me, more pressure to looking at a possible two-state solution, looking at pressure for negotiations between Hamas and Israel. That's getting reported more. Ukraine, nah. Actually, I think the Pope agrees with me. I'm very happy to note the Pope thinks that there should be negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, according to some reports out this weekend. And I have hoped that, in fact, there is more going on behind the scenes that we know about. I'm not sure there is. And it doesn't come up. What we hear about Ukraine is they need more ammunition,
right,
and the Republicans are blocking it. That's
right.
Pretty much what the story is
right
now.
That's the story, right. That's it. That's interesting. And the war in Ukraine has, you know, it's not in the headlines as much anymore. I mean, the destruction is the same as it ever was with what the Russians are doing. But my curiosity was piqued thinking of Ukraine being attacked by Russia when your essay mentioned something I had not heard of, a classified year-long study which used the Ukraine war to rethink its playbook. Tell us about that. How come we haven't heard a peep about that?
Well, it must be unclassified because I read about it in the Washington Post.
That's true.
So I think at some point, it looked as if there were clearly photojournalists there and probably journalists reporting from it. This was interesting to me because, you know, the cliche that generals are always fighting the last war.
Yes.
Well, this one is, the last war doesn't apply anymore. So it kind of, looking at Ukraine, said counterinsurgency, which was the biggie in the 20 years war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not going to work anymore. It's not what, and that's not necessarily where we need to put our money. So they, and because what's happening in Ukraine is more on the ground fighting, not close to face to face in certain situations. So they were looking at the role of technology. They apparently were training soldiers to dig trenches and foxholes, which I guess I think foxholes are probably out of fashion for quite some time now, but back in. But also, I mean, there were a lot of interesting things there, at least to me, that the ability to track any sort of technology. So somebody using a cell phone could give away the location of troops. And so some of this is that as technology changes, the military response has to change. And Ukraine was giving a good instance of how that worked. And some of it was that, oh, we better rethink where we're putting our resources and how we're training people, because it looks like at least this war is different. Now, if generals are always fighting the last war, what about the next one? Are we still going to be one behind? I don't know.
Yeah, that makes me think about the use of horses in World War One. That there was generals fighting the last war. The horses got slaughtered. About 800,000 horses died. For what? Well, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Nan Levinson, who has taught journalism at Tufts University. She's got a new piece called Is There Journalism That Doesn't Love a War? And she has a notable anti-war book, War Is Not a Game, The New Anti-War Soldiers as the Movement They Built. Well, we'll get to that before the end of the show. We're in an age of instant media, you know, social media. And as you point out in your article, quote, only 5% of adults now prefer to get their news from print publications. And no one seems to trust any news outlet other than the Weather Channel very much, end of quote. Well, Trump exacerbated this by insisting that anything not favorable to him was fake news. And a lot of people buy that. A lot of people buy that. If they don't like a story, oh, it's fake news. The media has it in for them or something like that. And many people fell for that line, and the distrust of the media grew. It used to be that Americans got their news from a trusted local paper, a radio or TV station. Now news consumers, and we are consumers, have an infinite number of social media platforms from which to choose. How much of a change in reporting style, in believability, do you think this has made? A big change or not so much?
I think there are changes over time that are significant. I do want to point out that I think many of us, if not all of us, are subject to confirmation bias, which is we believe what confirms what we already believe.
Right.
And so, you know, if a news story tells us what we think is true, we say, yeah, that's right. And if it doesn't, we find arguments with it.
Right.
And that I don't think is new. Certainly the distrust of the news media is new, although there have been other times when that's happened. It tends to be a pendulum swing.
Mm.
By the way, a lot of people told me they don't trust the Weather Channel.
Right.
that was the response I heard. But statistically, it is way at the top of everyone's list. But in terms of the plethora of sources, many of which I don't think are necessarily journalists reporting, people having opinions or picking up a little piece of information or putting stuff together. I think one of the things that happened is the self-selection. I still read a newspaper in print in the morning. I like it with my coffee.
Yes, do
and
I.
And I'm often struck by how the juxtaposition of stories, how one page will have all the awful things going on in the world, and you read all seven of the stories and you think, oh my God, ads next to a story. All of that affects how we read stuff, how we understand stuff. There's also some studies that say that we absorb more stuff that we read in print than online. I don't know how accurate that stuff is, but I've read some of that. I think the ability to click links to go back and forth. Simply how we read, not just what the material is, has changed how we perceive things. And it feels more ephemeral. And it feels maybe easier to yell back at, for all I know. Mm-hmm. And though journalists now are encouraged to brand themselves, we don't have the same kind of hagiography for the newscasters
at
6 o'clock news or whatever that we did once have. Edward R. Murrow and
Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, all of that. That all has changed. And to a certain extent, I don't think that's so bad. I mean, I don't want to have one person determine what I know or what I think. So I think that a variety of sources, on the one hand, is very good. I think it is not unalloyedly good. It's the problem. It's got its own issues.
And in this age of social media, it amazes me how, well, people... I don't know how often they check, you know, they read things on the internet, and somehow if it's, you know, in print or, you know, in digital format, it must be true. But you can't do that in the actual news media. And I know there's been a lot of competition, average people wanting to put out their version of the truth and their angle on things to compete with the actual news media. There aren't, as you say, you know, the Edward R. Murrows anymore. And, you know, as I look back on Edward R. Murrow, as much as I admired him, his slant was not subtle. It was really out there. We tend to forget that. And, you know, Walter Cronkite had a slant too. And we all have to be aware of that, I think. I don't think there is or can be truly objective reporting. We are humans. I don't know what your thoughts are on objectivity in the media, if it's something that, I think it, my guess is it's worth trying for, it's worth attempting, but what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that journalists are human.
Yes.
And they are, like all of us, the sum of many experiences, many ideas, many thoughts. That said, journalism tries, I always talk about being fair to the story, which may be a cop-out, as opposed to, you get as close to the truth as you can. Mm-hmm. And there are ways to do that. Journalism, verification is really important. There's an old cliche that is, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. Actually, I have a friend who said, how do you check out that your mother loves you? But that aside, you verify. You don't go with the first source.
Right.
People lie to journalists, and people have their own agendas all the time. And journalists know that. And good journalists do check out the information they get. They try to get as close to the truth. They sort through. They challenge arguments. I think, you know, journalists tend to be skeptical for good mm-hmm. reason.
Yes.
So I think, yes, we can't get past totally who we are, but there are practices we can put into place and we can hone and we can work really hard at to rise above it as best we can and to try to get to the truth. Also, that it's not just one journalist, it's lots of people. There are editors involved, one hopes.
Yes.
And all the various voices with people putting their opinions out there, I think it can be helpful in as one sorts through them. Mm-hmm. I think the problem more is that people don't sort through them, that we go to the ones that we like and that we agree with, and we say, yeah, and that's enough.
That's true. I mean, many people go to Fox so-called news. I go to the New York Times, you know, or the Washington Post. And people go to it's part of how it works, certainly. We, you know, like to go with something that we trust. And journalists really do try very hard, I think, to just present the truth. And I always find it impressive when I read or see a reporter on TV and I don't know where that person is coming from. That's good. That's really good. And it's a tough job, They work hard, and most of them don't get paid a lot of money. Some of them do. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about a very important part of democracy, and that is journalism. I think it was Thomas Jefferson, I may be wrong on this, who said, if we have a choice between government and newspaper, he'd take newspaper. I don't know exactly who said that. But anyway, our guest today is Nan Levinson, and we're talking about her piece in Tom Dispatch, Is There Journalism That Doesn't Love a War? And as you point out, Nan, that Americans respond to national anxieties, real or imagined, by arming themselves to the teeth, both personally and nationally. And it seems no matter the horror of mass shootings, be they little kids, as in Sandy Hook, or random adults, as in Lewiston, Maine, more recently, nothing ever changes when it comes to the proliferation of guns in America. What role, if any, does the news media play in, blaring headlines at each tragedy and then dropping the stories soon thereafter? I mean, when the stories disappear, the movement for gun control seems to fade out as well. Your thoughts?
They disappear, and then it happens all over again someplace else, and they appear again.
Yes.
I don't think we're necessarily inured to the slaughter. I don't think that's necessarily happened any more than I think with someone who watches war movies necessarily becomes John Wayne. I think it's more subtle than that, but I do think it gives us a feeling of helplessness. And maybe that's because I feel helpless when I keep reading this over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you do about that. And I don't know that that's journalism's fault necessarily. It's important to put stuff in context. And I think that's maybe where sometimes journalism falls down. It's the news and it's not the context of the news that this is, but we often do get this is, the 100-and-umpteenth school shooting this year.
Right.
What we could do about that, it's not necessarily journalism's role
right.
to solve the problem.
No, for sure.
In all fairness, it really isn't. And some journalism sometimes does and tries to come up with positive stories. When I report on something that I think is bad, I do try to see if anyone's doing anything about it, because I think that's the story. But I think that, again, it's the contest. This country, we like to think of ourselves as peace-loving people, but this country's built on violence. I mean, it's so much in our bones.
Yes, we
just do accept that people have guns and that Congress isn't going to do anything about it. It's the thing about taking people's guns away, even the way that's phrased, it's baked into our DNA in some way.
Yeah, it seems to be. And people, I think, the reality that after every horrible mass shooting, nothing happens. Just that process tends to reinforce people believing that they can't do anything about it because nothing ever changes. Well, we can do something about it. It's just people can be active and people can make change. We do have some degree of democracy left and people's voices do matter. I mean, the people's voices are rising up with regard to the Israel's war on Gaza. And it's having an effect. I mean, way too many people have died so far, but it does have an effect. We don't have censors in America. We don't have a heavy-handed, iron-fisted government breathing down the necks of journalists, thank goodness. But do you think there's an unspoken pressure on them to stick with the pack and not veer off? We've heard that phrase, pack journalism. What are your thoughts about that?
Sure. I mean, there are also a lot of them that don't. But, if the New York Times or Washington Post has a story, everyone else has to have the same story.
Right.
I tell a story. Somebody I know who was a journalist, I think with the Boston Globe at the time, was sent to Iraq. And he was in Baghdad with the News Corps, and it was a slow news day. Nothing was happening. And someone came back and said, hey, there's this one-eyed lion still in the zoo in Baghdad. And all the journalists went running out to take the story of the one-eyed lion in the zoo, except an old hand who got a hold of my pal and said, "That's not the story. Come with me. We'll rent a car. We'll go and we'll find what's really happening." And so I think about the one-eyed lion in the zoo as kind of the metaphor for the stories that get repeated over and over. Mm. But they're also, they're enterprising journalists. And there are a lot of places where that is rewarded, but it takes time and it takes money. It takes a solid newsroom that gives you 6 months to research a story. Mm. It gives you the time and the resources to do that. And there aren't a lot of those anymore. Oh, I was just going to say that one of the things that I did want to bring up is how newsrooms are organized or how journalists are assigned. And we have war correspondents. I've been beating the drums for a peace beat.
Aha, uh-huh. I was going to get to that. Good. Tell us about the peace beat. I think that's a very interesting idea. There's the war beat. You know, people, I would think if you're a hungry journalist and want to, you know, move up the ladder, getting a war assignment would be a plum. But what is this, you're talking about a peace beat?
It's somebody, you know, in fact, there are probably people who think of themselves kind of as that, the diplomatic correspondents or whatever. And apparently Wikipedia is this long thing about peace journalism, but it tends to be small religious organizations put out newsletters or uh-huh. something like that. Uh-huh. But it's kind of putting up the thinking of peace as not just a negative of war.
Right.
But actually, it's something worked for and sustained. It's looking at who we consider experts to talk about stuff. What about instead of having generals? I mean, yes, have generals talk about war. Not that you mm-hmm. don't have them. And politicians who are often in the pocket of arms manufacturers,
yeah.
Which is like most of our legislature.
Yes.
But people who are working on mediation negotiations, who are looking at long term, if you looked at not just the kind of the troop movement, but the politics and the moral stuff behind it, mm-hmm. And if this were an ongoing thing, not just bringing up here and there in reaction to certain wars or certain conflicts. Or even just who we consider important. There was a guy, Johan Galtung, who was a Norwegian, who's known as the father of peace studies. And he's a biggie. I mean, he did a lot of important stuff. He died in February. Have you seen an obituary anywhere?
No, I have not.
Nor I. Peace groups have it, which is how I find out. But he seems to me significant, not just because I care about this as a beat, but as a person in the world, as significant as a lot of people who get obituaries. And I've been kind of mystified why he hasn't shown up. But it is part of that peace doesn't seem to be something you report on.
Right.
And peace, in fact, isn't just an absence of war. Positive peace is a much more active thing. And there is stuff that's interesting to report on there. It's not just a boring ho-hum, the kingdom runs well.
Right. And, you know, you write, and I think this is a very interesting point, that 69% of the American public wants Ukraine to negotiate with Russia. And I can't help but think that the momentum is with that wanting Ukraine to negotiate with Russia. And I'm guessing there would be a market for a peace beat. I don't know if anybody's really trying that aside from the religious media that you've talked about and the peace media. I can't help but think that there's a hunger for that. I didn't want to let you go without getting a plug-in for your book, War is Not a Game, The New Anti-War Soldiers and the Movement They Built. Now, these people, I mean, certainly one of the main energies that ended the war in Vietnam was the guys who came back, and I think they were all guys at the time, from Vietnam who had seen the war and realized this is nuts. This is really terrible. And they fought a war against the war and helped bring it to an end. Well, tell us about your book, War Is Not a Game, the new anti-war soldiers and the movement they built.
I'd be glad to, but I do have to say there were women involved too.
Oh, well, good, I suppose. It's too bad anybody was sent to Vietnam, but anyway, go ahead.
No, but also women involved in the anti-war movement and Vietnam, that's against the war.
Yes.
So my book is, it's narratives. There was a Iraq That's Against the War, which has been renamed. It is now About Face and has changed focus. But these were men and women, often young, often working class, often not having a higher education, often having joined up so they could get money to have higher education.
Right.
Were sent to more Iraq because it was written when that was more active, but also Afghanistan, and came home and decided that, actually had decided while there, that this was really a bad war, that it needed to stop.
Right.
And they wanted to testify about what they had done and why they thought so. And so they organized. They were not ever as large as Vietnam Vets Against the War. They were not as effective. As we know, the wars went on for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have an impact, and they told their story to anyone who would listen, and they did some interesting actions. And I love them. There were Philippines. One of them said to me, you know, maybe we're reinventing the wheel, but it's going to be a really nice wheel. They were committed, and it's quite wonderful. And what's been fun for me is I've followed up with some of them, and we're quite many years after, and some of them are still very much involved, but their active actions and activity and was very much a part of who they became. And what I liked, I always talk about how during the war we thought of our troops, they could be either heroes or victims.
Mm.
And these people, it's another dichotomy there, were sometimes either or both of those, but they were also activists. They decided to do something about it. And
yes,
that was what was really interesting to me. And that's really what the book is about.
Interesting. Yeah, we always, I like to hear optimistic stories and human nature. You know, people, news goes fast, really fast, item to item, you know, bam, bing, bing, bing. And people got tired of the war in Vietnam, perpetual war on terror. People get tired of that. And I think people are getting tired of Donald Trump. I wonder if this impatience may have a positive effect when it comes to ending wars.
That would be wonderful.
It would. Well, this has been really interesting, and it's good to take a look at the news media. We still have a free news media in the United States. Who knows if the orange thing gets back in there, which, well, please, no. But, you know, because he doesn't like the media. He calls what he doesn't like fake news. This has been very interesting conversation. I really appreciate it. The book is called War Is Not a Game, The New Anti-War Soldiers and the Movement They Built. Who is the publisher, by the way?
Rutgers University Press.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive. And it's so good to look at journalism. Thank you.
And thank you. I've enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Nothing.
Listen to me.
Oh,
I despise. Cause it means destruction of innocent lives. War means tears. 10,000s of mothers die when their sons go out to fight and lose their lives. I said war. Good God, y'all.
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.